Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Elliot Bazzano. For every program, we choose a new and exciting book and chat with the author. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Christian Lang, professor and chair of Arabic and Islamic Studies at Utrecht University in the Netherlands, about his wonderful book, Paradise and Hell in Islamic Traditions, published by Cambridge University Press in 2015. Professor Lang's Paradise and Hell in Islamic Traditions was recently awarded the British Kuwaiti Friendship Society's Book Prize, and it presents a rich, challenging, and meticulous account of how Muslims have conceptualized the spiritual world across the centuries. With great perspicacity, the author explores Sunni and Shi'i views on his topic, as well as Sufi and mystical understandings, with attention to contrast and similarity amongst the schools of thought that he studies. In order to disrupt assumptions about popular conceptions, Professor Lang frequently employs the term otherworld instead of perhaps more expected terms like afterlife. On this note, one of the arguments the author presents throughout the monograph, based on his extensive research, is that Islamic traditions have often articulated this other world as something connected to the material world, even if it is also transcendent in important ways. Thus, one of the book's many strengths is its ability to present challenging paradoxes in ways that are accessible, while grounded in textual tradition. In addition to drawing upon numerous textual canons, including Quran and Hadith, Professor Lang also makes effective use of art, as well as modern data analysis, in order to observe things like how many times a key word for paradise or hell appears in various texts. And in order to complement his lucid yet erudite writing, the author includes tables and images to help guide the reader. The organization of the book, moreover, with its clear subsections and chapter themes, will prove helpful for educators and researchers looking to explore particular facets of the book's topic, even if the arrangement of the book allows for it to naturally build on its previous sections. This engaging monograph will likely interest scholars and teachers of classical Islamic thought, soteriology, textual hermeneutics, and art history, among other areas. I hope you enjoy the interview, and without further ado, here's my conversation with Professor Christian Lang. Greetings, Christian. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Elliot. Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, I'm really excited to chat with you about this book. It touches on so many different things, so we'll have a chance to discuss a few of them. So one of the things we like to do at New Books in Islamic Studies is begin by asking authors how you got interested in the field. So how did you get interested in Islamic studies?
Well, yes, with pleasure. That's a question that you and other people in the field, I guess, get all the time. So I'm used to the question. I answer it with pleasure, even though I find myself answering it in different ways. So apparently I haven't totally figured it out myself. But the one thing that I say always is that I came to Islamic studies with pretty much a clean slate. I had no background whatsoever in Islam or no Oriental languages in high school or as a teenager. So it really started when I went to Tübingen for my undergraduate studies in the 90s and met some amazing scholars and mentors who got me into the field. So I started with philosophy, really, and comparative religion and law, criminal law in particular. And then because Tübingen at that time was such a great place to do Islamic studies, to learn Arabic and Persian and other languages, I caught the bug and never looked back.
Uh-huh. And so as you progressed and went through your graduate studies and did graduate work, who were some particularly influential mentors or particularly influential pieces of scholarship that you encountered?
Yeah, it's a long list, but I would have to start with the people in Tübingen. There were four people that influenced me deeply, I think. Heinz Hahn, the historian of the Fatimids and other dynasties, who I admired very much for his ability to tell a good story. If you read his books on the Fatimids, I mean, it's really just a great pleasure to read these books, now luckily translated into English. Then there was Manfred Ullmann, the Arabist, who was the compiler, author of this amazing dictionary, Das Wörterbuch der klassischen arabischen Schriftsprache. And then Heinz Gaube, an Iranianist and art historian who really had a very broad vision of the field, invited me to Syria and Iran and in many places. I owe him a great deal. And then there was Josef von Ess, who was probably the most formative influence then, who also got me into a graduate school at Harvard. I mean, he was the one who recommended I go to study in the U.S. And then in the U.S., there is another quadrumvirate of supervisors to whom I'm indebted, and that is Bill Graham, my supervisor at Harvard, who introduced me to many things, among them the aesthetics of the Quran, I suppose. There was Roy Mutahede, who really kindled my interest in social history and the nexus between social and religious history. Wheeler Thaxton for Persian literature. I admire his skills as a translator and a philologist greatly. And then last but not least, Barbara Johansson, who supervised the last part of my PhD dissertation, which became a book in 2008, and was really very much about Islamic law. But it was also the starting point for my current interest in Islamic eschatology.
Well, that's a really rich background of networks, and I think also that kind of genealogy comes through in the book too, with just the really different kinds of references that you cite and ideas you engage. It adds a really rich perspective to your writing as well. So, as we jump into your monograph that we'll be discussing, Paradise and Hell in Islamic Traditions, this also has some relation to an edited volume that you produced shortly before the monograph came out. So could you say a little bit about the relationship between the two books?
Yes, well, and maybe I should start with my first book, because that really got me interested in...
Yeah, please.
In the Muslim hell, and that kind of triggered the whole project on Islamic eschatology. So the first book looked at conceptions of justice and of punishment under the Seljuks, the 11th and 12th century. And one of the things that I discovered, and I was, inspired to do this by Roy Mutahede at Harvard, was the ways in which the imagination of hell and the punishments of hell somehow seems to mimic sometimes, or at least has a very kind of strong conceptual connection with actual state violence on earth. So I moved from a punishment as an instrument of power and justice to looking at punishment in the hereafter. So that got me started onto hell, and Jacques Le Goff's work on the birth of purgatory was important back then, because he also put his finger on these very intricate and interesting ways in which imagined punishment in the hereafter, justice in the hereafter, correlates with punishment and justice in this world. You know, the idea that there's a continuum between these two, that it's not a question of punishment, justice on earth first, and then in the far eschatological future, justice and punishment in the hereafter, but that these things should be considered as kind of parallel phenomena. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that got me started on the topic of hell, and I went to a very nice conference organized in Göttingen, I think some 6 years ago maybe, or seven, by Sebastian Günther and Todd Lawson, which was called Roads to Paradise. This was a conference devoted to Muslim ideas about paradise and all kinds of different traditions of thinking about the topic. So not just theology, but also philosophy, mysticism, you name it, etc. When I was talking to Sebastian Günther during this conference, he said, or I said rather, well, you know, you did this beautiful conference on paradise, but shouldn't there be a conference on hell as well? And that got me, that stimulated me to organize myself a conference on the Muslim hell in Utrecht. This was in 2013, I think, and the proceedings, or the book that you refer to, is the outcome of this conference on the Muslim hell. My idea was that the Muslim hell has been very much understudied in Western Islamic studies, and that we should take it seriously also as a kind of interpretive challenge and look at it closely. So this was the story to introduce, as it were, the edited volume, which is called Locating Hell in Islamic Traditions, and was published last year with Brill as open access, so everybody can actually just go to the internet and to Brill's website and read the whole thing. And then in parallel with that, I was awarded a major research grant by the European Research Council in 2011 for a project on paradise and hell. So I supervised three PhDs and a postdoc, and had myself time to work on aspects of Islamic eschatology, and these four people all produced very nice books themselves. One wrote on Ishraqi philosophy and the conceptualizations of the hereafter and the world of image in the thought of As-Suhrawardi and his school. Somebody else wrote on a Sufi commentaries, tafasir, dealing with descriptions of the hereafter. And another one looked at Zuhd, early Zuhd traditions and early Zuhd thinking about eschatology. So this was a very rich background on which then to write my own book on Paradise and Hell, which is kind of an attempt to survey the entire tradition, all the traditions of thinking about Paradise and Hell in Sunni Islam and also in certain Shi'i traditions. I mean, there are limits to how much you can do in a book, but I think it is the most complete survey that we have of the topic so far.
Yeah, I mean, personally going through it, it definitely gives a flavor of comprehensiveness, even though, as you say, it's impossible in a way to be totally comprehensive. So before we jump into the book, one more sort of preliminary question. So you've talked a lot a bit about engagement with scholarly communities. And, of course, the concept of the afterlife is something that, you know, a lot, dare I say, most people have thought about at some point in their life. And so I wonder, have you had any memorable conversations with just random people when it comes up that you're working on this project of heaven and hell? Have there been any kind of like memorable reactions that people have shared with you when you tell them about your work?
Yes, two things come to mind. One fairly common reaction is to say, well, why bother really? I mean, these are just figments of the imagination. Why should we study it and spend so much time thinking about it? I think I have more to say about this in due time, Elliot. The other reaction that was a bit funny, I thought, but also I think got me thinking was when I gave a talk about the Muslim hell to a bunch of Jungian psychoanalysts. This was at a conference of the Eranos group in Switzerland, you know, the famous Eranos group, which also goes back to Jung and people in his surroundings and Gershom Scholem and Mircea Eliade and so forth. So they still run these summer workshops at the Lago Maggiore in Switzerland. I was invited to come and talk about the Muslim netherworld, the Muslim hell. So I talked about the Muslim hell for about 2 hours or something. And then afterwards, a lot of people came up to me and said, well, you really have to be careful not to this is strong and dark stuff. And you have to watch out for your psychological well-being, basically. And it's true. I mean, I kind of laughed it off, but if you look at this literature, particularly the literature on hell, it can be it is very violent and sometimes also obscene and not always a nice read. But that also makes for, I think, the importance of studying it. I mean, sometimes the comparison that comes to mind is that of a horror genre. And horror movies are taken very seriously by students of media culture. So I think in the same spirit, we should take representations of the afterworld of hell, but also of paradise very seriously.
Sure. Yeah, I think the horror movie analogy is interesting. I'd never thought about it in those terms exactly before. So let's start with the title itself and the key words. You use paradise and hell. So could you say a little bit about what you intend by those keywords, and then what other kinds of keywords from Islamic hit languages inform the types of conceptions that you investigate in the book?
Yeah, well, it's a great question because I thought about the title for a long time, like all of us do, I guess, when we write books, when we get the chance to publish a book. And particularly because the most commonly used terms in Islamic languages are al-jannah wa-nar, or jannat and duzakh in Persian, I suppose. But jannah and nar are very important, and they translate literally as garden and fire, of course. So why should we use paradise and hell instead? And I think I have good reasons to do so, because in my perception, these terms garden and fire in English don't capture the full range of phenomena that are discussed under the heading of Jannah and Nar. I have a sense that Jannah and Nar in much of the literature have become totally reified and ossified concepts. So people don't actually think of a garden in terms of green meadows and trees. They don't think of a fire that burns. They think of a lot of other things as well. I mean, there's a lot of material culture in Al-Jannah and in Anar. There are buildings. There are mountains also. I mean, the topography is much bigger than, what you would think of when you hear a garden or when you hear fire. So I think in that sense, it's justified to use paradise and hell instead of garden and fire, because these terms sketch out a much broader horizon than garden and fire. So that was behind the choice of sticking to paradise and hell because they do seem to belong to the Christian tradition more than to the Islamic one. But anyway, I felt that they gave a better sense of the richness of thinking about these two places. Mm-hmm. You also asked about other key terms. The key dichotomy that preoccupied me very much when I was writing the book is the dichotomy between ad-dunya and al-akhirah. So this lower world and the other world, it's very interesting to talk about various ways and possibilities of translating al-akhirah. Sometimes we'll see it translated as afterworld. I always felt that otherworld was a much more appropriate translation, because in many of the genres and traditions that I looked at, the idea was not so much that paradise and hell come after this world and are therefore afterworlds, but the idea seemed to be that they were other worlds that mirrored or somehow interacted very intimately with the world of the here and now. So I prefer the translation otherworld. I mean, it depends, of course, on context and so forth. But to me, analytically, that made more sense, and I was inspired in this, I guess, by a German scholar of religious studies who wrote about paradise in terms of Gegenwelt, a world that is set against this world, in the sense of a world to think with rather than a world to expect to come at the end of time after we die.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. You start the book off with sort of a way to underscore that idea of this man who is interacting with this leaf from some other dimension. And I think so you set that tone early, of course, yes, which is a provocative way to think about heaven and hell, which, right, I think a tendency is, to assume that it comes later. But you show and you argue that the way Muslims have actually conceived of these things is actually more dialectical and challenging over things like temporality and space.
Yeah.
And so if we go back to the notion of comparison, you mentioned there's key terms that relate to Christian tradition in particular kinds of ways. So when, as Muslims began to conceptualize the other world, what kinds of other religious and philosophical traditions were they interacting with?
Well, they certainly interacted with the Quran, and the Quran itself, I suppose, is interacting. I mean, there seems to be a broad consensus about this now, interacting with a whole range of late antique traditions of Judeo-Christian traditions of thinking about the other world. If we look at the entire history of Islam, of course, There are philosophical influences, a philosophical conceptualization of paradise and hell emerges early on and then gets its first kind of formal formalized first its first form in the thought of Avicenna and then the people who follow him. There are tendencies to internalize paradise and hell in the mystical tradition and so on. So I mean it's paradise and hell, I think, is fascinating. It's a fascinating topic because you, if you follow it through the centuries, you see how from all these angles people are starting to appropriate the afterlife and use it as a way to frame their their deepest convictions, philosophical, mystical, religious, or whatever. So it's a very complex question that you're asking, and much could be said.
Sure. So maybe one way we could focus on that is you talk about, as you're focusing on Islam, how the Quran and Islamic tradition creates an original kind of vision of heaven and hell. So could you say something about what is it about the Islamic tradition or traditions that distinguish themselves from other ideas about afterlife conceptions?
Yeah. Well, so this relates to the first chapter of the book, which is dedicated to paradise and hell in the Quran. And indeed, at the end of the chapter, I asked the question. So, because previously in the chapter, I talk a lot about the ways in which Quranic descriptions of paradise and hell resonate with texts such as the Apocalypse of Paul in the Christian tradition, certain Jewish texts. So a lot of this seems to be shared. So what then, if any, is the originality of the Quranic paradise and hell? Let me say one thing in the beginning. So the question of originality, of course, is perhaps a bit anachronistic anyway, because the Quran, in my views, the Quran simply is very much embedded in this late antique context. So we shouldn't expect a completely, it would be impossible to expect a complete break with the tradition and something originally new. But I do think that this idea of the synchronicity of dunya and akhirah and the nearness, the proximity of these two realms is a very pronounced feature of the Quranic message. So, for example, I look at verses in the Quran that talk about the location of paradise and hell, and there seem to be two competing traditions in the Quran, one that locates paradise and hell beyond this world, and another that locates them either on the world or somewhere at the nexus between this world and the other world. So this is the sense of proximity that I'm aiming at. Another thing is you often find in the Quran expressions that refer to the reward of the blessed in paradise, or indeed the punishment of the sinners in hell, as things that are already happening or have already happened, and not just in reference to the martyrs. There's the famous verse that talks about the martyrs not being dead, but enjoying the company of their Lord right now. But there are other verses that talk about sinful people of past societies having received punishment in the hereafter. So again, I think, and this then, is kind of a theme that runs through the tradition. The Prophet goes on his famous night journey, goes to visit paradise and hell, and he sees people being rewarded and people being punished as he goes there, which very much suggests and is indeed taken by some as proof that paradise and hell coexist with this world. And I think this has its roots really in the Quran. We'll have to see if, true Quran scholars will see anything in this and agree, but that's the starting point, as it were, of the entire book. And then the other chapters really, I guess, just try to flesh it out and show traditions that pick up on this theme, elaborate on it, and other traditions that go against it, because these also existed, of course.
Yeah, so in terms of trying to get a sense of what Islamic conceptions of heaven and hell look like, what occupies these spaces, if spaces is even an appropriate word, and perhaps you could say something about that. But what kinds of beings and occupants do Muslims write about as existing in these realms? Because you talk about it's more than just humans. There's other kinds of beings and perhaps organisms.
Yes, yes, of course. In the Hadith literature on this, there's a great number of beings that populate these two realms. So if we look at that particular tradition, Hadith literature, traditionalist literature on paradise and hell, there are traditions that talk about different animals in both paradise and hell. There are spiritual beings in paradise and hell. In paradise, of course, the famous houris or the maidens of paradise and the angels. In hell, there are the angels of punishment, the zabania, hell's angels. And then there are classes of damned and blessed jinn and people in both hell and paradise as well. So we have these three layers, I guess, that sum it up: animals, spiritual beings, and classes of damned in hell, and classes of the blessed in paradise.
And so, how you separate conceptions of heaven and hell into various time periods? Could you say a little bit about how and why these conceptions evolved throughout these discrete but overlapping time periods that you write about in the book?
Yes. So this also refers to the traditionalist literature on paradise and hell, basically collections or compilations of hadith about paradise and hell. First of all, I think there's kind of a natural tendency for this kind of material to grow over the centuries, because it's stuff that is really gripping. It inspires it speaks to the imagination. So I see it, the kind of accumulating thing over the centuries. And you see that if you compare the earliest collections, starting with, let's say, the chapters on paradise and hell in the Kitab al-Musannaf of Abd al-Razzaq al-San'ani, and then going on to Ibn Abi Dunya in the 9th century, and later authors, Abu Nu'aym al-Isfahani, al-Qurtubi in Spain, Suyuti, and then also in later centuries, and lots of these texts exist and are there to be studied. You see that they grow over the centuries. So Abd al-Razzaq is still relatively limited in the number of traditions that he reports, but then in Safarini, for example, in the 18th century Palestinian Hanbali collector, it's literally volumes of traditions about paradise and hell. So there's this natural tendency for this stuff to grow, I think, which is also facilitated by the fact that the criteria for reliability of hadith in the area of eschatology were never as strict as in other areas of hadith. So legal hadith, I think, for example, had much stricter criteria. In the area of eschatology, there seemed to be a kind of general consensus that it's okay to use these hadiths because they inspire hope and fear and inspire a pious way of life. So there was not really something to hold back the growth that I described. But still, at certain moments in time, you have attempts to limit the material and weed out the crazier stuff. So you have periods of expansion and contraction, as I call it. And I would say that, for example, the moment or the period of the so-called canonical collections in Sunni Islam around 900 marks a moment of contraction, because Muslim is very selective in what he accepts as sound hadith in the area of eschatology, and Bukhari also. Tirmidhi is the one of the among the canonical collectors who's a bit more generous. So this is contraction. But then, in the centuries following that, you get people like Abu Nu'aym al-Isfahani in the 11th century who, where the material explodes again. And then you have another moment of contraction when you come to the Hanbalis of Damascus and under the Mamluks, who also were very interested in eschatology and collecting eschatological hadith, but who start out with fairly limited collections. And these collections then again grow over the centuries. So the Maqdisi family, some representatives of the Al-Maqdisis in Damascus produce books on paradise and hell that are fairly short. But then you move on to Ibn Kathir and Ibn Rajab al-Hanbali and others, and the material expands again. So I distinguish between three periods of expansion, so up to the canonical collections, then up to, let's say, the 12th and 13th century, and then after the 13th to the modern period, and two moments of contraction around 900 and around, let's say, 1200. But I think I'm the first to talk about the history of the genre in such terms, so it's a bit tentative. But when I submitted the proposal for this book to the publisher, one of the reviewers said, yes, it's all very interesting, but he should really try to develop a historical argument. So that got me thinking about how to historicize the development of the genre. But now it's a long answer. Sorry, I'm talking a lot. But I've only talked about one genre, of course, in Islam, in Islamic religious literature that talks about paradise. And now we could also talk about all kinds of other genres, mystical literature, theological, etc.
Yeah. And I think the historicization is helpful because, it helps the reader understand how ideas change and develop, expand and contract, like you're saying. If I could ask you one more question about the hadith literature, which is something that struck me personally, is you do a search in the digital search for al-Maktab al-Shamila, and you talk about these terms, al-Jannah wal-Nar, and how frequently they occur, and you compare them. Could you say a little bit about that and the significance of their proportional kind of occurrence?
Yes. It's a table. Thank you for bringing it up, because I'm starting to, I guess like many other people in the field, I'm starting to really get interested in Arabic digital humanities and the opportunities that they bring. So what I did here is indeed I ran a search through various of the biggest collections of eschatological hadith in Sunni Islam. So I started with Abd al-Razzaq al-San'ani, then Ibn Abi Shayba. I did Bukhari and Tirmidhi, and then also some of the later collections, al-Tabarani's huge collection, and then al-Muttaqi al-Hindi in the 16th century. And I was interested in the ratio between the terms Jannah and Nar and how they may change over time. And what we see is that Jannah becomes more popular over time, but it's not the case that in the early centuries, so in the first and the second century, or I should probably say second and third century rather, it's definitely not the case that there is a lot of that Jannah is much more prominent than An-Nar. So the idea that there was a great certainty of salvation in the early centuries, and that only later hell came into the picture, and this has been suggested by some other scholars, I think needs to be rectified. And going even further back, talking about the Quran itself, very interesting, the discussion that's never really been fully explained or spelled out, I think, about how prominent a place paradise occupies in the Quran in comparison to hell. So you have people who will say, oh, paradise is much more important in the Quran. It's about salvation and kind of a positive religious discourse that unfolds, and others who will say the opposite. So I did a count myself, and we can talk endlessly about how you want to count these instances in the Quran, because Jannah and Nar are not the only terms that are being used. Of course, there are other terms, and there are descriptions that don't use any names of paradise and hell, etc. But what I found was that hell is indeed much more frequent, not much more, but more frequently used or described in the Quran than paradise. And this is continued, I would say, in the earlier collections of hadith. And only, I guess, I don't really know when, I guess around the 9th century or later, the ratio shifts and paradise gets the upper hand. But, it was a bit of a thought experiment, I must say. I mean, with digital humanities, I think you really have to look at a lot of material to really make a point, and I looked at something like 10 collections, so maybe somebody or maybe I should do it again and look at more texts.
Yeah, I mean, it was provocative for me to see the table and have that kind of thing spelled out. And so actually on the note of hadith collections and who considers which hadith collections valuable and not so valuable, you also in the book compare Sunni and Shi conceptions of hell. So could you say a little bit about how Shi conceptions of the afterlife differ and are similar with Sunni conceptions?
Well, first of all, these early collections of hadith about paradise and hell begin with Shi'i contributions. So I talked about Ibn Abi Dunya and Abdurrazzaq al-San'ani. Around the same time or even earlier, we have the earliest dedicated collections to paradise and hell, and they were penned by Shi'is. So there was a strong Shi'i interest in this kind of thing from early on. There are basic some well-known differences between Shi'i and Sunni conceptions of the afterlife. So famously, for example, God is not seen in paradise in Shi'ism, but rather a light is seen, whereas God is seen according to the kind of material that you find in most Sunni collections. But at the same time, I think, you know, that the other world of paradise is really not any less sensual or corporeal in Shi'i Islam than in Sunni Islam. In the big collections of eschatological hadith of the later Middle Ages, I'm thinking of Al-Majlisi's two books on paradise and hell in Bihar al-Anwar, but I'm also thinking of someone whom I found really very, very interesting, also a Shi'i collector from the 16th century called Al-Bahrani, Hashim ibn Sulaiman, 17th century, Hashim ibn Sulaiman al-Bahrani. There are many, many traditions about the plants, the kind of in paradise and hell, the kind of garments that people in paradise wear, the kind of bodily pleasures that people have. So I wouldn't say that the Shi'i conception of paradise and hell is any less materialist or sensual or corporeal than the Sunni one. Not if you look at these big collections that I talked about from the period of the Akhbaris in the 17th century. But what is true is that in Shi'i theology, there's this influence of As-Suhrawardi's idea of the Alam al-Mithal, the world of image, which is quite, I think, prominent in later Shi'i thought, and which is not something that the Sunni mutakallimun pick up. Some of them, I think, do. Taftazani, for example, quotes followers of Suhrawardi occasionally, but like the standard kalam works of later times, al-Iji and so on, don't really pick up the idea of a world of image. It's much more in Sufi thought, and then I'm thinking of Ibn Arabi, of course, and among Shi'i theologians that the idea lives on and is elaborated.
So since you mentioned Ibn Arabi and Sufism, that was something I wanted to ask you about as well. So in terms of this, you know, very big genre of Sufi or mystical literature, how does this genre distinguish itself from other genres?
Well, there's also, interestingly, there are also Sufi-inspired collections of hadith about the afterlife. It's something that you come across in the later centuries. I think it has to do with the fact that via Ibn Arabi, this idea of the Alam al-Mithal, or the world of image, makes it acceptable to talk about the particularities of paradise and hell again. So around something like the 15th century or so, there are these Sufis who start to compile collections of eschatological hadith. So there's an Algerian called Abdurrahman al-Tha'alibi in the 15th century, then famously the Egyptian Asha Arani in the 16th century, who does a kind of muhtasar, a short version of al-Qurtubi's collection. And then in later centuries, you can think of people like Abdul Ghani al-Nablusi. So at a certain point in the development of Sufism, this seems to become more acceptable to also trade in these eschatological hadith. And I think it is because this idea of the world of image makes it possible. And there the idea is that paradise and hell are neither spiritual nor totally corporeal. They are somewhere in between. It's the domain of the imagination. And the imagination is active somewhere in between the concrete and the abstract, right? So So that becomes important in the wake of Suhrawardi, and he actually takes it from Ibn Sina, from Avicenna, who seems to play with the idea. And then from Suhrawardi, you also find it in Ibn Arabi, independently of Suhrawardi, and from there on in Shi'i thought and in later Sufi traditions. But the history of Sufi thinking about paradise and hell is very rich again, so I would have to talk about other and more things as well, if you will let me.
Yeah, so we can come back to that as you like. Since you mentioned the notion of imagination and images, that was something else that struck me about your book as a material object as well, as you include several images in the book.
Yes.
Was that something you had thought about from the onset of your research? Was that something that informed your research as you developed your project? Could you say a little bit about the role of images in your book as well as your research?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. With pleasure. I think it's a fairly rich tradition. There's a fairly rich tradition of of figurative representations of paradise and hell in Islamic visual arts. My initial idea had been to do a kind of encompassing collection of these things and either put it into the book or do a separate publication. The publisher then didn't really want it, I guess, and also the person who commissioned it for a series, and that was the late Patricia Crone, said, well, then would become, you know, even a much bigger book and maybe a different book. So she advised me not to include too many images. So I included some 20 or so, but it's very interesting stuff that you can cull from a variety of traditions. So the Faalnamis, the books of Omen, for example, include representations of paradise and hell and the Day of Judgment. In some of the Qisas al-Anbiya collections, there are images of various prophets going to paradise and hell, not just the Prophet Muhammad, I mean, first and foremost Muhammad, of course, but also other prophets. And this kind of material hasn't been collected in one place as far as I know. I mean, there are some very valuable and useful books, which I mentioned in a footnote, I think, at the end of the introduction. But that is a book that remains to be written, and I hope that maybe some art historian with an interest in this can do it, because I think it would be quite interesting.
Yeah, and I think, the sheer number of footnotes in your bibliography, combined with the images, too, as you know, I think makes your book such a rich ground for people to take up future projects, which I'd like to ask you about in a little bit. But, I mean, following this line of you looked at so many different kinds of sources, and I can only imagine, so looking at the process of writing the book a little bit, that you came to some unexpected twists and turns. And so what were some of the biggest surprises that you encountered, either researching your book or thinking about it as you wrote it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, some of these surprises were, of course, simply the result of my previous ignorance of some really rather basic things. But, you know, when writing and researching the chapter on Sufism, for example, I only then did I realize that paradise and hell are really quite rather detested and very important, perhaps even dominant Sufi traditions. So I thought, well, this must be a feast for Sufis, and was expecting a lot of literature on it. But and there's a certain period in the, I guess, suppose the classical period, if that's the right way of talking about it. People have issues with calling anything classical in Islamic intellectual history. But around the time of Rabia and these Sufis from Baghdad, and she's the most famous example herself, there's actually a kind of contempt for paradise and hell as things that, or realities that detract attention away from God, and that therefore shouldn't preoccupy the true seeker. But then a little later, or perhaps even concurrently, you also have Sufis who start to internalize paradise and hell and talk about them not so much as places, but as inner states. So it creeps back into the tradition. And then, as I said earlier, with the thinkers in the tradition of the world of image, Ishraqi philosophy and Ibn Arabi, paradise and hell conquer or reconquer a place, as it were, in Sufism. But this whole, I mean, this variety of views about paradise and hell was something that really struck me. And then the other thing that I think is worth mentioning, that I would mention, is that it increasingly dawned on me how important the idea of the imagination was in this whole history of paradise and hell. How it comes up with, I guess, Avicenna is really a very important moment, and because he plays with the idea that in addition to a spiritual afterlife, there is an imagined afterlife. And this is picked up, I guess, by Suhrawardi and Ibn Arabi, but it seems to become very, very important. So that was something that I hadn't fully expected, but that I think is relevant and exciting, I hope.
And fast forwarding several hundred years from the likes of Ibn Arabi and Suhrawardi, what about as you put the edited volume together and you're benefiting from the ideas of lots of different contemporary scholars? I imagine any given chapter had an impact on your thinking, but what were some ideas in the edited volume as you put that together that stuck out to you?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. All these chapters somehow ended also up inspiring sentences in my book. And I should also mention that the proceedings of the conference in Göttingen that I mentioned at the beginning will be published by also by Brill, under the editorship of Sebastian Günther and Todd Lawson and Christian Lauder. And I went to the conference and then later wrote to people whether they would be willing to share chapters, and many agreed. So I'm also very much indebted to the people who contributed to this Paradise volume. From the volume that I edited, one thing that I learned a tremendous amount from one article was by was De Smet's piece on Ismaili conceptions of hell, which is not a completely different world. It belongs, I think, very clearly into the philosophical tradition of thinking in Islam, but it's a different project from that of the Shi'i thinkers. And many of these Ismaili authors are quite they're not obscure in the sense that they are unknown, but they are difficult to read. So Sijistani, for example, I struggled with, and I think without Daniel De Smet's chapter on Ismaili conceptions of hell in the volume that I edited, I don't think I could have written the pages I devoted to Ismailism in the book. So that was a very useful piece for me. There are other great pieces I recommend. I mean, it's open access. I don't, you know, it's everybody has access to the volume anyway, so I'm not trying to sell anything. I liked also Wim Raven's chapter on popular cosmology and hell in Arabic popular cosmology of the later Middle Ages. So he looked at a text known as the Kitab al-Azama. There are several of such texts. This one is an anonymous one, probably from the later Middle Ages. And it is a companion piece to a piece he wrote in 1993 on paradise in the Kitab al-Azama. And it's really, it's not scholarly literature. I mean, the Kitab al-Azama, it's more like popular cosmology, but it gives a great insight into how the imagination really kind of almost runs amok in the tradition. Very creative and very exaggerated also in many respects. But that's also a really good piece that got me thinking.
And so as I look at the edited volume and the monograph, of course, the edited volume is broken up into sections. And the monograph, I think, is broken up in a really helpful way to identify different threads and sort of look at discrete sections. And so it made me wonder, as I often do when I read books for New Books in Islamic Studies, have you had opportunities to use this book in a teaching context specifically? And would you have advice for the many professors that listen to this podcast in terms of how they can incorporate the book either in a graduate seminar or undergraduate context?
Yeah, I taught a class on Islamic eschatology at Harvard Divinity School when I was a postdoc at Harvard, but then I taught the topic, I meant, but then of course I hadn't written the book, so no, I haven't actually used it in my own teaching, even though I guest lecture on Islamic eschatology here and there. I think It depends a little bit on whether it's an undergraduate or a graduate seminar, I suppose. But the middle chapter is kind of a summary of traditionalist eschatology. It's based on four major hadith collections on the other world, Qurtubi, Suyuti in Sunni Islam, and Majlisi and Bahrani on the Shi'i side. So I think that would be the most comprehensive summary of the image of paradise and hell in the pre-modern tradition. So I think that would interest students. And I know of a friend who's an art historian that he has begun to use the last chapter of the book, which talks about architectural representations of paradise and hell in this world, and also about ritual, Islamic ritual, as including elements of pre-enacting paradise or hell on earth. So that would be a chapter, I think, that would be of interest to historians and scholars or students of Islamic material history and art history. But yeah, I mean, as you said, the book is divided into pretty separate chapters devoted to separate genres. So a chapter on the Quran, a chapter on Hadith, a chapter on kind of pious ethical literature, a chapter on theology, on philosophy, on Shiism and on Sufism. It's fairly conventional in that sense, I suppose. I talked to Josef van Es once about this book, and he said, well, the next step would be to write a history of paradise and hell that is not organized according to genres, but according really to centuries. But that would be a different project, I suppose, and maybe one that can only be written or be done once you have looked at the genres. But any of these chapters, I suppose, could fit into a different classes taught on, you know, different traditions.
And so this relates to one of the last things I'd like to ask you as we wrap things up. So in terms of current and future projects as they relate to this one or depart from it or expand, etc., what kinds of things are you currently working on, and what kinds of things do you see yourself or would like to see yourself working on the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I'm still continuing, of course, on the topic of eschatology. Even though I think my tendency will be to write kind of one book on a topic and then move on to the next. The first book I wrote was on justice and mostly on legal traditions. This one is on eschatology. I have plans for different books in the future. But anyway, I continue publishing on these things. And I've also launched a book series which might be of interest to certain people at Edinburgh University Press, together with David Cook, the scholar of apocalypticism. It's called Islamic Apocalypticism and Eschatology, and the first couple of volumes will come out, I think, well, not this year, but next year for sure. One has appeared already, so I'm doing that. And I also think that there are a couple of articles, perhaps even a book that could be written, that I would like to write about eschatology, about popular eschatology. There's this one text that that is fairly well known because it's been edited several times and translated. It's called Daqa'iq al-Akhbar. That's the most well-known title. It's a Sunni popular eschatology of probably the 12th or the 13th century. There is a series of articles from the 1960s, if I'm not mistaken, by John MacDonald about this. And I see a lot of people use these articles as kind of, you know, when they need a footnote about Islamic eschatology. But the text is very, as I said, popular. So it's not really an accurate representation, I think, of the learned hadith tradition, not to mention of the philosophical and theological tradition. So I think that text deserves a fresh look and maybe a new translation and commentary. So I might be doing that, but at the moment I'm doing something really quite different. I'm writing a short book in Dutch on Mohammed, which is a challenge because Dutch is not my native language. I've lived in the Netherlands since 2011. But I thought, you know, since I'm here, I should write something in Dutch. And then the next project, if you care to know, is yeah, something different. It's it's again how these things go, I suppose, is that you work on a book, and then there's one aspect that really interests you and you make another book of it. So this was the case with my first book when I first looked at hell and then decided to write a book on paradise and hell. One of the things next to the imagination that I found really interesting in writing this book on paradise and hell was the sensual aspect, the sensory nature of the Muslim afterlife, which, you know, of course, has been the reason for a lot of non-Muslim polemics against Islam, because, you know, a lot of criticism has been leveled against Islam for having such a sensualist notion of the afterlife. But beyond that, I find the topic of the senses, the bodily senses, and how they are involved in processes of world making, I suppose, very interesting. So I'm thinking about doing something on the senses in Islam. I'll have to see if that really can be converted into a book, or perhaps it'll be an article. But that's what I'm currently working on, sensory history of Islam.
Well, cool. It's been really exciting, Christian, to learn a little bit about your other projects, and as well as to talk to you about the book. And I'm really grateful that our listeners will be able to, you know, have this conversation, and also that you've pointed them to the resources such as the open access version of the edited volume and the series you're editing, and future projects to expect. So thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to seeing your work continue to come to fruition.
Well, thank you, Elliot, very much for having me. I greatly appreciated the opportunity. I should also like to mention that if your listeners want to talk about these things or exchange ideas or get in touch, they shouldn't hesitate, of course. I can be found very easily on the internet, and I'd love to exchange ideas with people. So thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
That was my conversation with Christian Lang, professor and chair of Arabic and Islamic Studies at Utrecht University in the Netherlands, about his wonderful book, Paradise and Hell in Islamic Traditions, published by Cambridge University Press in 2015. Thanks for listening.